Hey, y'all, this is Monica. This is the second highlight reel of my three-part conversation with Ian Davis on the multipolar world order. Enjoy.
Multilateralism, really, what it means is just more nations having a say in decision-making. So you might think that, you could say that the G20 is more multilateral than the G7, because, you know, obviously there are 20 nations contributing to the decision-making. Multipolar is a slightly different concept, because that really is about breaking the world up into blocks. So if you look at the G20, for example, there are five groups in the G20. So the groups, I think, three, four, and five are broadly split in geographical terms, but groups one and two are split in more kind of what I guess you might call aligned political and economic interests.
Yeah, they're like the bulge bracket regional hegemons.
So you've got the bulge bracket one and two, and then you've got geographical split in the other three groups. So,
I mean, you can almost think of that as like a corporate hierarchy where you have kind of a division head, and then the divisions that report to them. Of course, they don't think of it that way, but.
Yeah. So the way of thinking about that is the G20 overall, if all of those countries are equally participating in decision making, is more multilateral than the G7, but the G20 is more multipolar than the G7, because the G7 is just one group, whereas in the G20, you've got five distinct groups.
And one thing that I did get out of this, I think it was an Olaf Scholz comment that he made, maybe at the World Economic Forum thing, something like that. I don't have the actual quote, but I have what my impression was of it, that it was also folded in, whereas the multilateral thing or the previous paradigm was more focused on nation states as being the dominant entity of control, whereas, and this is very World Economic Forum, it moves towards a sort of stakeholder concept, which I think one of the things that you said was basically the nation state one, the oligarchs, or the G7 one, the oligarchs had influence, whereas with the G20, they more have control. And I feel like they fold into that with the World Economic Forum, that all of these stakeholders are really, say, philanthropies, labor unions, corporations, stuff like that, that look like they're representing different factions of society, but really are kind of political entities that serve the agenda, that exploit those factions. Kind of like, I know you're a Brzezinski fan. That's what I got out, or not fan, but yes, that you find his work illuminating in understanding how things have progressed. In his Crisis of Democracy, which was, I think, one of the first things the Trilateral Commission did, he got a bunch of people to write these essays about how what went wrong in the 60s. And then he says, as a takeaway, well, in order to control democracy, we need to make sure every single person, and this is me paraphrasing, every single person is a part of an institution that is non-democratic, but that their livelihood or their interests are tied to, so that if it's a corporation or a labor union or a university or whatever it is, they'll go along with that and they won't really have that kind of a say. Now, some of the people who contributed to that collection of essays objected to that as being the takeaway. But of course, the reason he put it together was so that he could. And I feel like this is, along with many other things that are a culmination of Brzezinski's, I would say, plan, others would say predictions, is, part of that, where it takes the power away from the nation states, away from anything democratic. And once you start that, you really have... Then they actually, I would say, it's not even multipolar anymore. It really will feed into the top of a level of self-interest at the very top among the oligarchs that we probably won't even really be aware of.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's a very interesting person to sort of, as a kind of a lens through which to look at what's happening at the moment. Obviously, not only for his effect at the, geopolitically and towards the end of the 20th century, but also the fact that some of his observations have been very telling. For example, he's Brzezinski. It's Brzezinski that talked about the game, meaning, you know, the geopolitical game, who made Ukraine a very important part of certainly Russia's global geostrategic ambitions, and, you know, made it a very important part of the US's ambitions for the Eurasian sort of landmass. It's not a continent, it's more than that. It's a, you know, it's a multiple continent in a way. But, you know, so I think he's interested in that perspective. But also, you know, obviously his involvement with the Trilateral Commission and their involvement with funding and certainly encouraging the development in China. You know, and I think it's interesting that something I think that stands out for me from, I think it's in the Grand Chessboard where Brzezinski, oh no, I think it's in the Technotronic Era, where Brzezinski speaks about the fact that nation states, that basically private corporations have already eclipsed nation states in terms of their ability to master resources and to control resources and in their strategic planning. So I think the difference between the kind of what we might call the multi-stakeholder partnership model is that in the same way that the idea of multilateralism is supposed to give nation states an equal say, I mean, obviously not all, but, you know, you wouldn't expect, for example, the Solomon Islands to have an equal say to the US on certain subjects, because obviously the US is representing a far greater body of people. So, you know, I mean, that's only reasonable and fair, perhaps. But nonetheless, the idea of multilateralism is that nation states have, relatively speaking, equal say. The idea of the multi-stakeholder capitalism, which is something that Brzezinski kind of highlighted again in the Technotronic Era, is that corporations have an equal say with political bodies and governments. So in a multi-stakeholder setting, you know, what BlackRock say is as important as what the US government says. They're on an equal footing. That's the point of the partnership. Now, I would argue that, you know, given something, a company like BlackRock that's got, I don't know, what is it, $8.7 or $9 trillion?
Yeah. I mean, I've read 10. Yeah.
Yeah, 10. Yeah. I mean, who knows, really?
Right. At that point.
Who knows? Yeah. I mean, but they can obviously have the ability to control resources, which is significant on a scale that's significantly greater than the GDP of many nation states. So if we're just talking about brute economic force, and I don't think that's necessarily the only, that's not the only factor. There are other factors that play into the exercising of geopolitical power. But nonetheless, being able to marshal and having oversight of resources on that scale gives you, I would suggest, significant political clout as well.
And would you say that this idea of the multipolar world order, the G20, could be like a front or a face job? Like, it looks like there are 20. So you have like, I mean, I'm sure Guatemala would not be in the G20, but say Sweden or somebody's in the G20. And it looks like you have this more equal playing field, that you have all these countries, and it could potentially mask the outsized influence of the oligarch, global corporations or these non-governmental entities that really dwarf any impact that Swedish, you know, president who's like getting all the fanfare and everything. I mean, she's obviously just saying something people tell her to say.
I mean, I think the thing is that when the UN was first established, it was established as a public-private partnership. It was set up by the Rockefellers, really, and their partners. It was, and, you know, people like the Carnegie Foundation and so forth. But I mean, really, it was led by the Rockefellers, and was created as a public-private partnership. Now, that was the idea from the very beginning. Now, because of the influence of corporations and so forth. Now that is totally contrary to our perception of it. You know, I would say that our perception of the United Nations throughout the certainly the sort of latter half of the 20th century, and because there was a lot of debate about the United Nations when the United Nations was actually first set up. A lot of people were very opposed to it because they saw it as...
And they wanted, and then the other people like Alger Hiss and stuff, they wanted it to be, to have the power to tax and the power to exploit. It kind of reminds me of the Fed. Like, you think of it as a public institution, but it's not.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could look at those arguments on a continuum, can't you? So at one end, there were the people that were saying that this should be basically a world government.
Right.
People like Alger Hiss.
For sure. They were outwardly saying a guy named Cord Meyer wanted to run it, and he later ran Operation Mockingbird. I know JFK was kind of like, maybe.
So at the other end of that spectrum, you had people that were just vehemently opposed to it, you know, just saying it's the end of national sovereignty and that. So... as often happens, you know, a compromise was met. But in the middle of that was a very strong influence from private capital. Private capital was what basically created what went on to become the administrative part of the UN. So, I mean, this private capital was always involved with it. But we have always we've just perceived it purely as an intergovernmental organization. That's the way that that 99.9% of us think about it. But it was never that. It was always more than that.
So when you say it was private capital, it was always a part of it, and you specifically cited the Rockefellers, is that right? Is there anybody else you could specifically say was in on it from the beginning? I always thought of it like the Rhodes, Rockefeller, Rothschild, you know, contingent as being it's that whole UK-US axis and anything more than that.
Yeah, I mean, and if you look at that, I mean, so you've got, who is funding this operation? So who's funding this?
Oh, right. It was, you know, Rockefeller contributed that land in New York. I mean, my father taught me that from, he's like, that's a Rockefeller project. That's right. So, it was really the Rockefellers. That's right. Right.
Okay. Yeah, but also who's behind the, I mean, the Rockefellers obviously are independently wealthy in their own right. But I mean, that network that Carol Quigley spoke about, Anglo-American network.
Yes.
Is, you know, there are multiple corporations involved in...
Right, Chase was his.
Chase. And then but then you got JP Morgan and people like that.
And then they rope in the government, the U.S. government, to pay for it. So, like, the UN, the U.S. government took a lot, like, the countries wouldn't pay into it. And that's another thing my father used to always balk about. Like, we pay for the UN and, like, other countries are supposed to pay us back. But that, of course, is just the Rockefellers getting somebody else to... You know, it's like Trump wants the Mexicans to build the wall. It's like they're just getting somebody else to build the wall.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, normally, I mean, these companies might be willing to invest, you know, I mean, corporations and oligarchs like the Rockefellers might be willing to invest some capital into it, but ultimately they want that money back. They want the taxpayer to pay for it. I mean, that's normally the way it works.
And the way they shape the world to benefit their other assets sometimes disconnects, you know, what they may lose in one place. I always think Rupert Murdoch, or people who own like the newspapers, like they probably have, you know, more money in oil and gas, and they just need the newspaper to get people on board with policies that promote their other interests. But
media has been a loss maker for
yes,
for,
of course. I mean, it's obviously a propaganda machine. It's obviously a public relations arm of certain enterprises. So I see a quote here from Smoggy. I don't know if that's pronouncing correctly, but he says basically that they're not, that the world is more and more economically integrated, but not financially or politically. And that there needs to be institutions emerging like that, that could be outwardly controlled to some extent by a G20 consortium, but that stuff that's more politically sensitive has to have the appearance of simply just being influenced or guided more in the style of the G7. So I found in that, and maybe I'm misreading it, but I found in that the idea that the G20 model is a step towards like actual functioning world government. And that I on the one thing that you have absolutely pointed out, we talked about this last time, is this move towards even just a tiny little universal financial tax, which you rightly pointed out in this article, like, is not really going to be borne by the financial entities that we're supposed to have no sympathy about. But it's really the foundation of what Alger Hiss wanted from the UN from the beginning, is like the ability to enforce, the ability to tax. And then one thing that I thought of you, I was looking into something yesterday about the French labor strike and exacerbating energy price problems in the UK, in the EU. I was reading about this yesterday, and I was thinking about how labor unions around the world right now are really doing unsympathetic things, which is unusual if you want to keep people on your side. And I thought we're moving, you know, the Great Reset really does have a lot to do with labor. They call it like the future of work, that kind of thing. And here, when we went to Zoom land, we pushed into the virtual world, forced into the virtual world a lot of stuff that people wanted to go to the office for. And now companies are having problems getting people to go into the office. And I say that's very short-sighted, because once you make your job not connected to your presence, your physical presence, it'll go the way of call centers. So here, almost all of our call centers are handled out of India. And it's because you can just make it remote. As soon as they make that totally remote, it's really going to impoverish a lot of people here. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be the foundation or the spark for a call for international labor laws, for some kind of international minimum wage tied to a basket of goods in any one country, or tied to a synthetic currency, something like that. So I see emerging environmental standards are a classic, you know, most obvious example of something that needs to have an international law, you know, that's being used right out of the report from Iron Mountain, which is like one of my favorite go-tos because it predicts basically everything. And so I see in that, like, what I think that maybe dovetails with this transition to the G20 is that they are serious about making real laws that can be enforced.
Oh, yeah, they're very, very serious about it. Yeah, I mean, I think also there's an element of it. It's like anything, that they're not going to. And one of the things that's most concerning is the speed of change that's happened as a result, I would argue, of the sanctions against Ukraine.
Yes.
Against Russia. That has accelerated this transition incredibly. But generally speaking, they don't try and enforce everything all at once. You know, they sort of drip feed ideas out. So at the moment, for example, if we're talking about central bank digital currency, at the moment, nearly every nation around the world is at a various level of development in terms of central bank digital currency. And notably, it was the World Bank, I think, put a report out, which, interestingly, you know, all of a sudden, it is the Western G7 NATO-aligned unipolar world order that is lagging behind in terms of developing central bank digital currency, which normally they would be at the forefront of that kind of thing. But all of a sudden, they're not. All of a sudden, they're lagging behind. And the East are, you know, Russia and China are surging ahead with that. And I think going back to what you were saying about in terms of, you know, establishing things like global tax systems and also about the future of work and the future employment, and you're quite right, there's been a lot of talk about that. I think the idea is, and we can look at people like some thinkers on the left certainly have been talking about this a lot in terms of kind of what you might call utopian, you know, socialist utopia or utopian socialism, is the idea of universal basic income. And I think that is where we're heading. And very interestingly, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, I think it was last year, they put out a kind of promotional thing called, what was it called? Future Scope, I think it was called. And in that, I mean, it was very much, they were talking about a new world religion, which would be the, you know, based around the Earth Charter. And I think it was actually called Earthism.
Oh, my God.
They were talking about everybody being on universal basic income. We shouldn't get carried away with this. These are ideas. They're floating ideas about where, and trajectories about where they want to go. But that's letting us know where they want to go. And I think we would be foolish not to. And then if you then look at the actions and what's happened, certainly in terms of the sanctions, for example, then it's all heading in that direction. So we should, I think we can put these two things together. I think we can put their wishful thinking together with the actual events that have happened and, you know, take them more seriously.
I do want to ask you about the UBI. You know, in thinking about this, do you think the UBI is about making disempowering people and really limiting their resources, reducing population ultimately, or just making them more controllable? What's your feeling about what it's really about for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all about control. It's all about, I mean, if you think about it, if you're totally reliant upon the state for your livelihood, right? So, I mean, it's the same really as being on welfare, but being on nothing but welfare.
Right.
You're on nothing but welfare. So you're totally reliant upon the state for your income. Even if you earn money independently, that money itself, if we have central bank digital currency, I mean, the nightmare scenario is the combination of central bank digital currency and UBI. You put those two things together and we've got, you know, we're in deep, deep trouble there.
Yeah, because the plus, that's a, you know, then it gets enforced the way YouTube does. You know, like you get censored for things that you say. Like I get taken off of YouTube all the time. I get strikes on YouTube all the time. That's going to happen to my debit card.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it's all, we've already seen this kind of thing happening in, for example, Canada. So if you, you know, when they froze people's bank accounts because they were expressing
them. And that was a shot across the bow. That was a warning.
Yeah, it's a warning, but it's also, you know, people see that thing and all that, as far as that goes for most people, is they go, oh, isn't that bad? You know, isn't that terrible? But that is the model. That is what they're building. That's what they're constructing.
I was reading about the kind of post-enclosure era of the in the UK, and that there were laws about being able to move from one place to another, being able to work from one place to another. And then if, you know, a factory opened up and they wanted to use you, they would, and they wouldn't obey the rules. But if you were the one who were instituting that, they could shut you out. I was shocked. I really have to read more about that enclosure situation, how it changed the world, really changed the direction. But don't underestimate the power of being limited in that way. And I always envisioned it in New York a decade ago when they were starting to do, they wanted to put a tax on sugary drinks. And then it was just pushing everybody into aspartame, which I was like, that's not better. But I thought at some point, if they have digital currency, they're going to be able to tax your first sugary drink at 10%, but your third sugary drink at 100% or 300%. So not only just geographically, but decisions, choices. As soon as you, I was worried about national health here because I thought they, and right after I said this, Bloomberg came out and he said, well, now that we're paying for your healthcare, we get to decide what goes into your body. And that's that whole totalitarianism, but they know they need the enforcement mechanism at a really granular level. And that's, I think, yes, that clarifies. That answers the question for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think people need to grasp just the level of control that these things would give them.
And I'm wondering, there are a couple of things that I always wonder if you think they're really done with such foresight that they're intentional or if they're a response to changing circumstances. And two of the things that I was thinking of when I was reading your article were the unsustainable debt and the rise of China. So I always go back and forth thing like, did Nixon open up China? Did we give China most favored nation trading status earlier than anybody else? Because they wanted China in a particular position. They wanted to have that tension between East and West. They wanted to bring up the East and push down the West so that it could integrate more easily. Or did they see that China was inevitably going to be a powerhouse and they wanted to get a foot in the door? And then similarly, they have absolutely pushed our debt to unsustainable levels at the same time that they shut down our economy. They clearly, that was the result of government action. Did they do that particular thing on purpose? Did they deliberately make the debt impossible to cope with so that they could trigger a financial crisis and bring in a new currency? Or is this stuff just one paradigm comes to an end and they anticipate that and try to get ahead of it? What's your opinion on those two?
Well, I think with regards to China, this is the way that we need to think about the people that are involved in this kind of thing. So a lot of people would have been working on, say, for example, Elon Musk, let's say. Elon Musk has got a large investment in China, right? The Tesla factory in China. So Elon Musk, and I'm not saying he does, I'm just guessing here, but I mean, Elon Musk might just simply see it as an opportunity to get a market opportunity in China. Obviously, it's an absolutely enormous market. He can obviously get, you know, labor at a better at competitive price in China than he could in the US. But also it gives him access to potentially to China's market, which is huge. So just from a purely economic, for no other reason, just from a purely economic standpoint, that makes sense. But if you also want to be able to do something like for assist Chinese technological development, then you can also do it through things like foreign direct investment. So there are some people I would suggest, and I would certainly suggest the Trilateral right. Commission, were very interested in establishing technocracy, and I'm with Patrick from Patrick's yes. view on this, were very interested in establishing technocracy in China because its political system, which is, I mean, you know, not being disparaging to it, but to China per se, but it hasn't got, you know, what we might consider to be a democratic tradition. It has right. come from a kind of feudalist system.
Commanding control. And we did that with Russia during the Cold War. Like, they did psychological experiments that we were not really permitted to do, but we exploited their results. And, you know, I think that yeah. there was some intention behind that. And like in Israel, they do some more surveillance stuff or tech stuff that we wouldn't go well. But yeah, so to have a place like that where you could do stuff like that as a stepping stone and then use that as an excuse to pivot towards it because look, yeah. now it's too late.
Yeah, and also, I mean, the population is more conducive to accepting yeah. that kind of top-down control. Right. They're accustomed to it. This yeah. isn't to say that there's no political debate in China because there's a lot of political debate.
No, but they don't have that history of individualism yeah. that we
yeah.
have.
Yeah, so they, you know, they got this Tianxi kind of idea of, yeah. You know, so
it's totally reasonable. I actually think it's obnoxious of us to go to every country around the world and act like their culture has no, you know,
well,
value.
Certainly China. I mean, China's culture's, you know, I mean, it's, you know, arguably, I mean, it's been the leading culture yeah. in the world for thousands of years, yes. hasn't it? So, I mean, you know. It is very arrogant.
And partly because it did not allow for individualism.
Yeah, yeah, very much.
Perhaps it could be argued.
I mean, yeah, it could be. It could certainly be argued. I mean, it's a certain different way of looking at things, isn't yeah. it? There's no kind of ontological kind of thought process in the sort of Chinese mindset. So, I mean, that's a very... We, from in the West, when we're looking at that, we can't... It's often very difficult for us even to wrap our heads around that.
Yes, and the way you're putting it, like I'm thinking about it now, yes, there's absolutely no way to have to really understand that from the inside. I it's actually an achievement to understand that it is so different, but that may be the genius in it because it becomes like a different medium, like an agar or whatever, a different medium for this experiment that, you know, we had an American experiment, which precludes this experiment from happening here. So there yeah. they can take that cultural medium and do a totally different kind of experiment.
Yeah, and I think so. What I'm basically saying is that there was a concerted effort to introduce technocracy to China.
Yes.
And but there was also an economic aspect in terms of, you know, like when Kissinger went over first. Before Nixon, when Kissinger went over there, what was on his mind? Now, he was representing the Trilateral, well, the Rockefellers yeah. and the Trilateral right. Commission. That's who he was representing. Yeah. He wasn't necessarily representing the United States.
No, I don't think
right? so. But when Nixon went over, he was probably thinking, I mean, I don't know. This
no,
is
I think so, because there's a lot of hidden audio of Nixon.
Yeah, so I think...
And they did take him out, so he probably did have an idea of what he was doing for the American people. They did take him out.
Yeah, yeah. So I think he's probably got a different... What I'm trying to suggest is he's probably got a different mindset to what he was doing in China compared to what Kissinger's agenda was. They were probably two different things, you know?
Right, so, but I think Kissinger influenced Nixon, and Nixon was probably duped in all of that. But yes, yeah. his motives were... Right, so the intention didn't have to be the same, but okay, yeah. But that definitely answers my question. It's like, I think, yes, they were intentionally doing something with China, and they have continued to do that for decades, seems to me.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look, I mean, I think it's notable that somebody like, you know, like Clinton, who was also in the Trilateral Commission, he lifted the embargo on China having what they were calling sensitive technology. So the US wouldn't export sensitive technology to China, but it was Clinton that lifted that embargo. So, and Clinton's a trilateralist. So, I mean, you know, there's an agenda there. I mean, yes, it's quite definitely obvious that there's an agenda there.
Yes.
So I think, but at the same time, China is a massive marketplace. So of course the US and the West and the, you know, the Europeans want access to that market just from a purely economic standpoint.
And it's important, and when you're thinking about these different players, it is, I think, important to just really visualize like a person making decisions for his own enrichment. Like I used to work in investment banking, and there were a couple of guys who were superstars who are still like, they're masters of the universe right now. They could probably find them a list of 10 people who basically are the most influential in the financial system. And I remember how those guys thought. Like they were geniuses when it came to the numbers and the money, and they had relationships with people like senators and stuff like that. They knew where the levers of power were. They were called up sometimes in advance. I read later in the Wall Street Journal, like, I knew that guy. He was in the room with Tim Geithner. Wow. And, but they are just ruthlessly considering their bottom line for sure. So they are not thinking what is good for America. They are not thinking about some trilateral agenda. They are in place because they are making that bank the most money it can make. And that is consistent with the agenda. But yeah, but that money motive, I think, is what actually gets those guys to pull the, you know, to put the yoke on that pulls that engine forward.
So if you imagine that you've got a different agenda, if you've got a different agenda, for example, you want this kind of global experiment, you want to move towards a multipolar world order, for example, then people like that are very useful. You don't have to change their minds. You just need to use them to the best of their ability. But direct their energy where you want it to go.
Right.
So you don't have to tell them what you've got in your mind.
Yeah, no, for sure not. Yeah.
You just need to let them do their thing, but do it the way that you want it to be done.
Yeah.
There's this one of the criticisms that I've had with writing about the multipolar world order is people say to me, well, how can you both say that there's this overarching plan, which I am suggesting, but at the same time, you've got these conflicts, for example, between Russia and Ukraine, or what looks like, you know, let's call it what it is, it's a proxy war between Russia and NATO.
Yes.
Right? So how can you have that happening at the same time as this? Well, of course, you know, people like, you know, the Norman Dodds and the Rees Committee and so forth, they, when he was doing his investigation, so he exposed the fact war is often quite useful. War can be used as a catalyst for change, and there are people that quite like to encourage conflict because that's quite handy. And I'm not saying that's the case in this case, but I'm just pointing that out. So there may be a genuine conflict, like there is a conflict between the upper echelons of management in a corporation. So a corporate, you know, in a corporate body, the board of directors might be frantically stabbing each other in the back because they all want to be CEO.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that the board of trustees and the beneficial owners and the shareholders haven't got a completely separate agenda and are overlooking the whole thing and driving that forward.
I have to say, I can give you an example carrying on from that very specific thing I was thinking of when I was in investment banking. And, you know, this guy is for sure master of the universe now. There was one time that somebody from on high called that guy and said, stay away from that fight. So it gave me the impression that all that infighting, you take what you fight for the corners, you get what you want, and it looks like nobody's paying attention because that stuff is good for them. Competition like creates, you know, like more wealth. But if something stepped over the line, only then do you say, you don't say here are the boundaries because then everybody knows what the boundaries are. If it steps over the line, you get a little slap down, keep it to yourself. I guess that didn't happen. But yes, that would be how it worked. And of course, war, you know, because we hate war, because death of little people is important to us because we're little people, it doesn't mean that they think of it that way. Big T they, it's not the worst thing that could happen. As a matter of fact, everybody gets rich in that level when you go to war. And then of course, you also have the great benefits of accelerating the CBDC thing, accelerating what might be a Petro one, which is you were talked about, all that. And as soon as that stuff, I mean, I'm not in the thick of it like you are, but just from a cursory view of somebody who's a little bit critical of the news, I was like, really? They're stealing their reserves? They're cutting them off of SWIFT? Doesn't that play exactly in their hands? Doesn't it encourage them to have, you know, off dollar transactions with people like Iran and India and stuff? Like, this is playing right into their hands.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the sanctions, I mean, I just want to quickly clarify on that thing. So if you've got the boardroom that are stabbing each other in the back, but they all work for the same company and none of them want to see the company fail, they'll all do their thing to ensure that the big project goes forward because that's in their best interests, but they can still have conflicts within it. And I think what we're seeing at the moment is a transition from West to East. Yes, there is a conflict. The focal point of that is Ukraine at the moment. But that doesn't mean that the overall project isn't going forward. And I think the overall project is being facilitated at the moment, as you quite rightly said, by... I mean, let's look at the effect of the sanctions. I mean, they make no sense. Yeah. They make no sense at all. Yes, they are going to impact on Russia. I mean, Russia's, but even Foreign Policy magazine was saying that this is going to push Russia and China together. It's obvious that it's going to push Russia and China together. It's going to push the BRICS together. It's uniting that kind of power structure in the face of an opposition, which is, you know, for want of a better expression, the unipolar world order or whatever people want to call it, the NATO alliance. Everything that NATO alliance is doing, and the constituent members of that alliance are doing, is driving the Western economy down and lifting the Eastern economy at the same time. Now, why would... I mean, that just makes... If you are a political leader of, you know, a leading nation state like France. The US, France, Germany, I mean Germany's position is
Merkel wouldn't do it. I think she was just like, I'm walking away with my legacy as is. Thanks anyway.
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly, I don't think it would have panned out the way it has because I mean Scholz is very weak, isn't he? So I mean, that's...
yeah, I mean, clearly, just it gave up on the North. She would never do that. And no. I mean, I'm no fan of her. She capitulated a plenty, but she wasn't willing to just completely abandon Germany. That was, it's just crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it makes no sense what they're doing.
Grain, it's the money, it's all the things that they're doing. They want to put gas gas price caps on, oil price caps on. All that does is remove those resources from your marketplace and pushes them and so far below. Yellen wants to put a $60 a barrel oil cap. I mean, it's just, it's not going to happen. So,
But also, I mean, we're seeing, so, I mean, if we look at the way that OPEC is moving away from the kind of US orbit and looking towards China and Russia, you got Saudi Arabia. I mean, that remarkable, I don't know whether you saw it, where the Saudi, I think it was the Saudi ambassador was just refused to answer Reuters questions because he accused Reuters in a debate of basically stitching up the Saudis and they weren't interested anymore and I'm not answering your questions.
Wow. No,
But I mean, you know, you've got people like Yellen saying, you know, we demand that we cap the oil price. I mean, it's weird, isn't it? I mean, it's like they've totally lost connection with reality. Because why would either the Saudis or the Russians consider that they would allow that to happen? Why would they allow that to happen? They're the ones that are producing the oil.
They're telling us, and I mean, they absolutely had to lay the groundwork for an incredibly stupid population. like incredibly stupid, because they're saying we're going to have a consortium of the EU countries. We're all going to negotiate gas prices, gas purchases as a block. We are going to steal the foreign reserves, the U.S. reserves, hundreds of billions of dollars of reserves, and we're going to refuse to pay the contracts in rubles. I don't know if you noticed that nuance. That's the problem. And they say that Russia's cutting off gas supplies. That is, from my research, that's not what was happening. They were having problems with the Nord Stream turbine. Now that the fucking thing blew up, you know, they're doing it all on purpose. You know what I mean? Like every single thing, it's maddening to me that they're feeding this line. And I guess from a perspective on the other side of the pond, you could tell me, I mean, are the people in the EU so stupid that they don't understand the illogic of this, or are they at the end of their ropes? Like my psyche is just trying to puzzle through it.
No, I think we've just seen big anti-war protests in Holland, and the French people are, I mean, the French have obviously been protesting against this kind of thing for quite a long time, although that seems to have subsided a bit now. But I don't think people aren't that dumb. Do you know what I mean? People know that they're being taken for a ride.
Yeah,
but okay. I mean, the question is, what are we going to do about it? You know, and we are trapped in this. The political paradigm that's given to us, and consequently people can't perhaps see a way out. I mean, the only way out is through the, you know, electoral politics, and who are you going to vote for? You know, I mean, we've got a situation at the moment where the UK unelected prime minister has just basically said that she's not interested in holding an election. She's got no mandate and she doesn't want one. She doesn't care. This is a strange situation to find ourselves in, and while all of this is happening. But I mean, at the bottom line of all this, and this is the tragedy, I mean, this is the worst part of it, is that people are really going to suffer because of this, in especially in Europe. I mean, during this winter, the vulnerable people are going to die. They are going to die because of this. You know, I mean, it's
well, they've been the target all along. I mean, that COVID and the vax too are about vulnerable people. A report from Iron Mountain talks about that. The next war has to kill the weak, not the strong.
It's always the same. Yeah, it's always the same. It's always the people that are least able to cope are the people that get, well, targeted. That's what it looks like.
Right.
You know, so you know, it's a terrible situation that we find ourselves in. But if you step back and look at the overall effect of what is happening. The overall effect, I mean, let's say energy, for example.
Yeah.
The overall effect is to shift energy flows globally. It's not just about the relative price and so forth. It's about where the energy is actually going. Now, the energy at the moment is going to China. China can't get enough. It can't get enough coal. It can't get enough oil, and it can't get enough gas. I mean, it is sucking up energy. Now, China's economy recently, because of crazy things like zero COVID policy, has started to slow down a bit. But nonetheless, there's still levels of growth there that we can't even possibly hope to match. Now, Russia is quadrupling its supply to China. It's quadrupled its supply to, yes, at capped. You know, it is subsidizing that to a certain extent. But Russia is rapidly moving towards a position where it won't need the European market. Now, when that happens, I should add that another point at the moment, and this is disgusting, and I don't know whether you're aware of this, Russia is currently pumping 42 million cubic meters a day of gas through Ukraine into Western Europe. Gazprom have just struck or resolved an issue with the Ukrainian national gas provider, which is, I think, is Nafgaz, I think. I'm not sure. I've probably got that wrong. And Russia is supplying gas. 42, I mean, this is a drop off because, I mean, normally it was up to about 300 cubic meters, million cubits a day. But now it's putting through 42 to 50 cubits, million cubits.
I mean, isn't that why they took Yanukovych out in the first place? Was it Yanukovych doing deals about, you know, gas and debt? And, you know, isn't that why they took him out in the first place? Is that he was.
But the politicians are saying they can't stop a war, right? They're saying they can't stop a war, and they're happy to kill each right. other's populations, but they're doing gas deals.
Yeah, that's in that book, Guido Preparata's book, Conjuring Hitler, about how even during all of that, 60 million people being killed in World War II, the money flows never stopped, were not interrupted. Yeah. And that was one of the earliest things, because there was a call to action. There's 7 calls to action on Johns Hopkins' website about COVID. And one of them was to shore up the financial system so that no matter what happened, money flows wouldn't stop. And I remember thinking maybe they're planning on a war and they just need to make sure that you know, the pipes are in the ceiling, not on the floor. And that sounds like energy is in that. Obviously, energy always is in that category of you know, up there with finance and defense.
Energy, food, money, water. These are the things that ultimately control us, aren't they?
And actually, I mean, that's interesting, because what goes around Ukraine for the gas, the Nord Stream things, and the Turk Stream. Turkey wanted to be a hub for the gas, and that pipeline was being sabotaged also. So they are sabotaging that. Yet Ukraine, you know, where they could most easily probably just blow that up or just turn it off, just say no. Yeah. And they're not. And I always felt like that Ukraine and Syria thing were happening at the same time, you know, over the past decade, because those were important gas conduits to Europe, up from like the Qatar, Iran, you know, whatever gas field there, and then up from Ukraine. And I kind of lost sight of how essential that was to all of this, because there's just so much noise around that war. But then Putin said, which something I had thought of earlier on was, and it seems so banal, but it's true, or venal, that they want LNG. You know, how could Europe possibly be a customer for US LNG? I mean, it's dangerous. It's expensive. The only way is if you cut off Russian gas.
Yeah, that's true, if you cut off Russian gas, but nor can Europe do that overnight. I mean, this is another problem as well. I mean, the amount of shipping you would need to ship over sufficient LNG from the US, but where's all the shipping?
And those ships are very special, because LNG is pressurized gas that's liquefied. I briefly had a job in this as an analyst at Citibank right out of college, and this was one of the things I looked at. And like, they're double hull ships. If like one drop of that stuff gets in there, it expands and blows the whole thing up and blows the port up. There have been accidents, and I just was always like, LNG is just not a good thing. You have to really secure it.
Yeah, but I mean, there aren't enough ships. There aren't enough ships at the moment to do that.
For sure not.
Right, there's nowhere near enough ships to. If you couldn't replace Europe's energy gas. Just gas. You couldn't replace Europe's gas requirements with LNG from the US now. You might be able to in 3 or 4 years' time, but Europe doesn't have the gas storage capacity. Europe doesn't have it. It doesn't physically exist.
Not long ago, they were burning gas. I mean, gas, it just shouldn't be that expensive. And actually, the UK is talking about signing a 20-year LNG deal. Did you see that? That just came across. Yeah. So, I mean, it is a long-term plan. But, I mean, so the only reason I bring that up is that it really speaks to what you were saying earlier about how, there's big picture agendas. I'm going to control the world. I'm going to have, like, you know, total surveillance at all time, a currency that you can turn on and turn off if you get out of line. And all of that. And then you have Putin saying, they just want the LNG business. You know, it's like, it's crazy that those things are the two, you know, one thing that's like so draconian to us. So, and the other is just basic monetary greed. It boggles the mind.
All these things are happening all at once, which is why it's all so fascinating.
We got to bring the white pill in, not because I, you know, not just gratuitously, but if this is where we're at and there's no hope whatsoever, then I love you, but I never want to talk to you again. And I'm just going to spend my life drinking cocktails and, you know, finding a perch on the top of the mountain and just hope that I'm far away enough that I can just watch it all burn and not burn down myself. But if it isn't totally hopeless, then we carry on. and where, you know, what is your, you know, what keeps you going, I guess, is my question.
Well, I don't think it's hopeless at all. I don't, these are all aspirations that, you know, so for example, introducing UBI and CBDC and having this global governance, this functioning global governance and all that kind of thing. It's all aspirational. Otherwise, we wouldn't be going through what we're going through at the moment. They're trying to install it because they're not there yet. And the solution to it is so simple. It's so easy. We just simply have to it's not just as simple as just saying no, but we need to be more self-reliant. As if we start being more self-reliant and we start focusing on each other and focusing on the things that are important to us right here and right now, and we start, you know, concentrating on things like how we're going to feed ourselves, how we're going to stay warm. If we really grab hold of those issues and we do what we need to do to look after ourselves, our loved ones and our communities and our families and our communities, if we all do that, they will become increasingly irrelevant. And in a generation or two, there is no reason why we can't have changed everything simply by taking control of the things that are important to us on a daily basis.
I will support that. I appreciate that. And I think evidence of it is that the propaganda machine is just so overwhelming. Like, they don't stop. They can't stop. It's like a fire hose. And so that's a tell that they need our minds. Yeah. And then the other thing is they absolutely cannot do it without us being slaves to tech. That you have to be slaves to tech, or it's just they have no power over you whatsoever. Screens are how they control the mind. So I can deal with both of those things. I can turn both of those things off, and it's not a bad idea to have your eyes on that prize. I know we're coming to the top of the hour, and if you have anything else to add, that's great. I'd love to hear it. And I also would like you to tell people kind of what you're working on, where they can find you, and if we can have at least one more of these conversations.
Yeah, no, I'll be delighted. Yeah, you can find me at my website, which is, as I said, it's Ian with an I, IAINDavis.com.
My favorite reading, for sure, are your articles. I really look forward to them.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you to say, so I appreciate
really
that.
Really true.
You can get my book for free on my website. It's not the hardback, but the PDF version. And there are other books on there that I've written and series that I've written that I've put into PDF bundles that people can get for free as well. And so just check me out there, and I'm on Twitter, and my handle is _ all one word, In This Together, and that's me.
Fantastic. Well, it has been such a pleasure, Ian Davis. Thank you so much for joining us.